Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Josie Warden. I'm a senior researcher in the economy team here at the RSA, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's event. I'm really thrilled to introduce today's guests, Farah Storr. Farah is the award-winning editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine, and since she became editor in 2015, sales have skyrocketed, taking it back to its number one position for the first time in 16 years. Before taking over at Cosmopolitan, she was the launch editor of Women's Health magazine, the most successful magazine launch of the millennium. Farah was due to join us a few months ago to talk about her new book, The Discomfort Zone, but was unfortunately unwell, so I'm really delighted that we've been able to reschedule and that she's back with us today to talk about her book. In the book, she explores the power of living, of stepping beyond what is easy and comfortable in our lives to create fearless, creative and successful life. It's a really engaging book with lots of insights and tips. And as we're reaching the end of the year and reflecting on achievements of the past year and thinking ahead to 2019, this seems like a perfect time to be talking about this. After her opening presentation, I will be asking Farah Storr a few questions, and then we'll open up to you in the audience for questions too. And we should have plenty of time for those before we wrap up at 2 o'clock. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Farah Storr.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here on, what day is it? Is it Wednesday? Thursday? Is it Tuesday? Well, thank you for being here at lunchtime. So I'd like to start, because you don't just get to sit here and do nothing, I'd like to start by asking you all to do me a quick favour. So in a couple of minutes, I'm going to ask you all to close your eyes, and it's not some sort of mass hypnotism, I promise. And I'd like you to try and recall your earliest memory, if you can, of being really afraid. And I want you to try and go back as far as you can. If it helps, mine was when I was about 5 years old, and it was sitting on Santa's knee. It's probably pretty scary doing it nowadays, to be honest. If he's even allowed, I was saying to someone, I don't think you're allowed to do it anymore. So I'm just going to give you kind of 10 to 15 seconds, and then I'm going to ask for some people to share with me what their memory is. So if you can just all close your eyes now, all of you. Excellent. Okay, so I'm going to give you about 10 to 15 seconds, and if you just all try and go back as far as possible. And more seconds, and then I'll ask a couple of people. Okay. Some people have still got their eyes closed. I think that means they're in a trance, this gentleman at the back, who opened his eyes and then he subsequently shut them again. Okay, do I have any volunteers? I just want like two of you just to share very, very briefly. You don't have to go into a lot of detail, but can I have like one or two very brave volunteers? This gentleman at the back.
I was quite a strange kid. I still am quite strange.
Good. And it terrified you. And how old were you? Do you remember?
4 or 5.
Okay, so you go pretty far back then. Yeah. Anyone else? What about this side of the room? Yes, lady at the back.
I think that's probably about 8 or 9. I got chased by a horse across the field, and it was terrifying.
That is terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying. Is there anyone here, and you don't need to go into detail, but if you just put your hands up, is there anyone here whose earliest memory was being frightened by a very loud noise, which I guess yours kind of is that. Anybody? Yep, so gentleman here and lady here, yep. And you as well? And what about anybody's memory being falling from a great height? Is there anybody whose memory was of falling off something? You, okay, so just one person. Okay, so thank you for doing that, first of all. The reason I ask that is it's thought that we're only really born. Babies really only have two fears, and those are fear of very loud noises and fear of falling, which means that every other fear that you have, so whether that's fear of being stood on a stage or fear of a job interview or fear of public speaking, fear of, I don't know, someone's Tinder biog that reads, you know, adventurous and not looking for anything complicated, which can be pretty scary. Those are all fears that obviously we pick up. We pick them up from the culture around us and we pick them up from personal experience. Now, that's not to say that some people are not born more fearful than others. In fact, I think it's 1 in 5 babies are thought to be born to be very fearful. And you can tell quite easily who those babies are, because actually when you take them near to a Playmobil, those things that kind of hang from the ceiling, whereas most kids will interact and they'll laugh and they love those things, fretful babies have a very different response. And what happens is they start to arch their back and they cry. They cry hysterically, actually. But then what happens to those fearful babies? Does it mean that they then go into life and they become fearful adults? Well, actually, what they found is 2/3 of those babies continue to be quite anxious individuals as they get older. Which begs the question, of course, what happened to the other third? Now, it's not that the other third, the world around them and all its challenges, changed. That didn't happen. And it's not really that they particularly changed. But what happened to that other third is that they realised that the only way to go forth into life and to stop being scared was to expose themselves to the very things that they were frightened of. And what happens, of course, is the world doesn't change, but you become braver and you become better able to deal with it. Now, I know this because I was one of those fretful babies. So I kind of came out of the womb screaming and never really stopped, actually, until I was in my teenage years. So I was scared of absolutely everything. I was the child at nursery who, you know, when my mother had to leave to go to work, I would stay at the window and I would be screaming uncontrollably. They had to move me from school to school because I was such a sensitive child. I just couldn't stand being near other kids. It actually didn't get much better for me because, do we have any middle children here? Okay, so maybe you will identify with this, but I was the third child of 4. So I had 2 elder siblings. I had a very outgoing older brother, and I had a very outgoing and very ambitious elder sister. And of course, what happens is, when you have bold, ambitious siblings, is they kind of go out and taste test the world for you. And that was very much my experience. I had an older brother and sister, as I said, who very much fought all of my battles for me. You know, at school, I was never a victim of sharking bullies because I had my elder sister. I never had any problems with boys because I had a cool older brother. And I think for much of my life, particularly for my early teenage years, I thought this was amazing. You know, all that I ever came up against in the world was things that were good or things that had been taste tested by my siblings. I kind of existed, I suppose, in a sort of proverbial comfort blanket, which I was very unwilling to leave, until I got to about 19 or 20, and my sister and my brother had kind of flown the nest, and I realised 2 things. One, I didn't actually know much about who I was, because everything that I had experienced came through this sibling filter. The other thing I realised was that the world was tough, and that in order for me to survive, I had to be tougher than it. And so when I was 20, I did something which for me was completely audacious. I booked a 1-way ticket to Paris in France. I was a complete Francophile, but I didn't actually speak any French. And I got a job in a school. And unbeknown to me at the time, the school that I was teaching in, it was one of the toughest schools in probably the toughest suburb of Paris. So it was really, really hard. I moved into a flat. I really didn't have much money. I moved into a flat with what transpired to be, I thought it was going to be 1 girl, but actually it was 2 mime artists, which was kind of useful because I didn't actually speak any French. We literally communicated through the power of mime the entire year. And it was really tough. You know, alone and afraid, actually, in Paris by myself, I came up against obstacle after obstacle, and I was very much thrown into my discomfort zone. But one of the amazing things about obstacles is that they teach you very, very quickly 2 things about yourself. They teach you your weaknesses, which actually I don't think everybody knows what their weaknesses are. But at the same time, they also teach you surprising strengths that you often don't realise you have. And in my situation, I discovered that actually, miraculously, despite not speaking any French, I could control this crowd. It was about 40 really really difficult kids. I could control them. And I also discovered that I was tough and I was street smart in a way that growing up I had never been told that I could be. And actually I never thought that I was. And so when I returned back to England from Paris, I discovered not only these amazing things about myself, but I also discovered that what I really believe is true to this day is that the human body and the human mind is made for discomfort. We are made to carry a load. We are made to withstand struggle. And actually, when I look back on my career, all of the successes that I have had, and the two major ones, have only come about because I was thrown into moments of discomfort. The first was when I took on my first editorship. It was a magazine called Women's Health. It was in tail end of 2011, which was, in magazine terms, it was a really cataclysmic time for magazines. 2011, digital was kind of rising, magazines were shuttering. People thought it was insane to launch a print magazine in that time. And so because of that, I was given the job, but it came with lots of caveats. And those caveats were I got two members of staff. We had pretty much no budget. And we had 6 weeks in which to build a magazine from scratch. And I remember at the time thinking, God, 6 weeks is really not a lot of time. And of course, they had had another editor, but she'd walked out saying, this is not possible, it cannot be done. And so I remember we were in this kind of airless room at the back of Selfridges, and there were just the three of us, and we were like, how are we going to do this? But I think because of all the constraints that we were faced with, time, lack of resources, lack of money, lack of team members, we actually started to behave in a way which we had never done before. We became much braver in our thinking. We trusted our gut in ways I don't think many people do. I mean, usually on magazines, what you do is you get people around a table and you ask for consensus. And what tends to happen is, and this probably happens in other businesses as well, is you kind of get, you end up with the great ideas kind of filter down and you end up with something that pleases everyone. We didn't have that luxury. And so I'll give you an example of something that happened because of all these constraints. So it was, I think it was like mid-December. I think it was this week in December. And we had just written a feature on breast health. And I was like, God, guys, how are we going to show, like, a picture of breasts? Like, I don't know what we're going to do. And they were like, no, don't worry. We'll use one of the agencies to find a picture. But actually, to find a picture of breasts, a nice picture, is very expensive. And so we just didn't have that luxury. And I remember we put it to one side and we're like, we'll have to come up with an idea. But as press kept coming, and press is kind of when the magazine goes, as it approached, we were like, we still don't have an idea. And I remember it was really late at night, I think it was about 10 o'clock, and we were in the office, and one of us, and I cannot remember who it is, looked down at their knees, and they had a dress on, I think. And they said, you know what, if you look at your knees with new tights on, from a bird's eye angle, it looks like a massive pair of breasts. And then we were like, oh, okay. And then we were like, and then if you put a pair of nude shoes on, and just have the tip, so you know where I'm going with this. And out of those constraints, out of sheer desperation, that's what we did. We took a picture of, I think it was our intern's knees. She put nude shoes on, and we blew the picture up huge across the page. It was across a DPS. And we sent it to press. And Women's Health, you know, I'm very grateful Women's Health went on to be a huge success, but the reason I mentioned that visual is because it was the one thing that everybody picked up on. They were like, this is a health magazine which just thinks differently. And actually what happened is that visual of the breasts / the knees set the visual tone for what we did with the rest of that magazine. And I honestly believe that was why we, in a very, very difficult time, why we achieved the success that we did. Very quickly, very similar situation when I launched Cosmo. I was given 4 months in which to kind of rethink the brand for millennials. As tends to happen, I joined, and 80% of the team resigned very, very quickly. And so I found myself yet again in a very similar situation to Women's Health, where I had 6 members of staff and I had time ticking away. And in those months, I remember we made some really what at the time seemed like very bold decisions. So, of course, Cosmo back then was very famous for its sex positions, its naked male centrefold. I don't know if anybody remembers that. Its sex agony ant columns. I mean, I remember I turned to the page and the agony ant that I'd been taking sex tips from was still there 30 years later, telling us all how to give blowjobs in exactly the same way, I think. And so what we did, because of the time ticking, we just got rid of them. We just scrapped them. So those were the real sacred cows of what this magazine and what this brand had been. And actually, it was trusting my gut, because I was forced to trust my gut, that we got rid of all of them. And I remember somebody saying at the time, it's a big mistake, you should never have done that, you should have got consensus. I honestly believe if I'd have got consensus, we wouldn't have done any of that. And consequently, and I'm not saying it's because I got rid of the Naked Centrefold, but consequently, Cosmo went on yet again. We increased sales by 60%. And one of the messages that came through it all was, it's something radically different for this brand. Now, the reason I'm telling you all of this is not to boast in any way, I promise you, but it's to show to you the power of constraints to really change your thinking. And it's to show how discomfort can really let your creativity take flight. Now, I'm going to give you a really good example of somebody who did this brilliantly. Steven Spielberg, as we all know, is one of our most iconic film directors. But in 1974, he was on his second film. Now, he just had one film out already, which was called, some of you may know it, it was called The Sugarland Express. And whilst it had been critically acclaimed, it had been an absolute car crash at the box office. And so he was given this film. It was a scare movie about a giant fish. And already they had had one director who had left the film, and so Spielberg really wanted to make an impact. So he really put the crew through their paces. He said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create this incredibly terrifying shark. It's going to be a mechanical shark, and we're going to spend this money on it, and it's really going to absolutely terrify the audiences. Once he looked around to see if anybody could make the shark, everybody said it's not possible. Spielberg kept trying and trying until eventually he coaxed somebody out of retirement to make, he called the shark Bruce after his lawyer, to make Bruce. Bruce arrived $250,000 later, which in 1974, I'm sure you can imagine, it was an enormous amount of money. And there were a couple of problems with him. One, he had these comically white teeth. Two, he was cross-eyed. And three, and actually this was the biggest problem, Bruce kept having mechanical failure after mechanical failure. And this was a real problem because Spielberg had already spent so much time trying to prove himself. He had been filming out at sea. They'd almost lost a couple of crew members due to drowning. So he had all this pressure on him. He was running out of time. He was running out of budget. And so he had to make a decision. Wait for Bruce to be repaired or think of another way of showing the shark. And so alone by himself one night, he started to think, what about if I didn't show the shark at all? What about if what the viewer can create in their mind is far scarier than what I could ever show with this mechanical shark? And so that's what he did. He was forced to rely on two things: moving props and John Williams's masterful two-note film score. Now, I'm just going to show you a clip, just for those of you who've seen Jaws here. Okay, well, you will all know this scene, but I just want to show you just how masterful it was. I don't know where the gentleman is. Can you play the video, please?
I can't get up!
I can't get up!
Come on, Charlie!
Help me!
Come on, Charlie!
Help me!
I need your feet out of the water! I'm getting your feet!
I would say never has a piece of driftwood looked so menacing. But do you see how effective that is? And actually, for those of you that can remember Jaws, one of the interesting things about Jaws is when you do actually see, I think in the last scene, he does show the mechanical shark, it actually looks kind of comical. It does look ridiculous. And so what the viewer can imagine is far more powerful. So I could give you many, many more examples of people, but my point is this. It's that we have figured discomfort out all wrong. You know, we see discomfort as oppressive, but actually it can be incredibly liberating and uplifting. We see it as something to shirk away from, but actually it's something to step into. I think the thing is, what I realised in Paris all those years ago, and which I still to this day believe, is that the human mind and body is designed to withstand discomfort. And I'll give you an example. Think about when you're nervous, what happens to your body? So your hands get clammy and your heart starts beating rapidly like there's a butterfly caught inside it and your stomach starts to feel like it's been macrame'd. Well, think about what happens when you're excited. It's the exact same things. So if your body manifests itself in exactly the same way when you're excited and when you're scared, then that means that it's your mind that's deciding which bank you fall into. And it's very, very easy to remedy that. In fact, scientists show, and there are many, many studies on this, that all you simply need to do is when you're feeling fear, is to tell yourself that it's not fear that you're feeling, but that it's challenge and that it's excitement. And when you do that, something absolutely magical happens. Blood starts flowing around your body quicker, your lungs enlarge, oxygen starts getting to your brain more readily, and you are able to make sharper and quicker decisions. But I should add, you literally only have nanoseconds in which to make that decision. Because if you leave it too long, we've all seen here what happens when people have stage fright. If you leave it too long and you tell yourself that you are frightened, then you can become completely overwhelmed by fear, and then it's kaput. So, I've told you two things today. One is that discomfort is something that we are prepared for. In fact, we relish it. And I've told you one of the tricks to put yourself into a discomfort mindset. But I just want to leave you with one thought before I go, because it's a thought that really deeply worries me, and it's something that I've been seeing more and more of, because I honestly think that the culture that we now live in is afraid of discomfort, and I think it is getting worse. I think, you know, we still live in a world where we have participation medals for first place and last place. You know, we see our universities now are creating increasingly these places called safe spaces where students can retreat from words or ideas that they find difficult to deal with. You know, I see it myself when people call the largest generation on earth, millennials, Generation Snowflake, which is a reference to their fragility, not to their strength. And I question whether that's the right thing. And I also question whether every one of us here in this room can honestly ask ourselves whether we coddle ourselves, because I know even I do it to myself. You know, we choose to exist in an online world where we only ever have to come up against the views and the opinions of people whose worldviews chimes with our own. And I think it's a danger. I think it's a dangerous thing. And so my plea to all of you is to share the message that actually you need to expose yourself to the very things that you are frightened of. We know that exposure therapy works. We know little by little. You do not retreat away from the very things that scare you, but you expose yourself to them. So my message is, step into the discomfort zone, because you will honestly be rewarded and realise quite how tough you all are. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think I'm actually still feeling quite anxious from Jaws. So I'm telling myself that it's not fear, it's challenge. It's really interesting as well to hear about the sort of developmental fears in children, and actually it's only a couple that are really innate and that the others are things that you've learnt. And you need to be able to remind yourself that this is something, you know, something that you've learnt and that you can kind of overcome in a different way. You talked a little bit then about things you can do, but do you have any sort of really, really practical tips of things that you've done in that moment to kind of ground yourself and get yourself prepared.
Yeah, I still get frightened all the time about things. The difference is actually what I do now in my life is I say yes to things, because actually if I wait too long, the fear will overwhelm me, and I know that, and I'll say no to things. So actually when I'm offered opportunities or things that I think are scary, I say yes, and then I figure out what I'm going to do. Because, you know, and part of the book explores this, I think all anybody wants is the illusion of control, and it's an illusion of control because ultimately we don't have any control over any of it, but you want the illusion of control. And so I think when you're going into something really scary, you've got to have a plan of how you're going to deal with it. And one of the things for me, and in the book I call it brief moments of discomfort, because of course no one situation is terrifying, right? It's like there are bits of an experience which are scary, but the whole entire thing isn't. It's like when I come up on stage here, the whole talk is not terrifying, but there might be bits within it which are. And so you have to identify what it is that's scaring you. And so an example, you know, I didn't used to like to do massive public speaking, like with big audiences. And I realised actually when I broke it down is it wasn't that I didn't like speaking, but it was I didn't like the moment when you first come on stage and people are still kind of chatting and you have to get their attention. And so I had to figure out a plan of, well, how do I do that? And so you'll notice I asked everybody to participate in something, and that was a skill that I learnt. It was like, well, what do people love? They love themselves. They love thinking about themselves. And so actually, if you get people involved when you're doing a speech, you instantly, by getting them involved, you take the pressure off you, you take the attention away from you. And so that was a device that I always use now. And what it does, of course, is it makes you feel in control of the situation. So, that would be my advice for people.
I think that comes back to your points now about kind of knowing yourself and knowing what your weaknesses are and also what your strengths are.
Right.
I was wondering, the book talks quite a lot about how you as an individual can take on these ideas, but what do you think we need to do to sort of help other people to do this as well? Like, what can we do to help our friends or families or colleagues to be able to kind of embrace this fear as well? What kind of cultures do we need or setups?
Well, I think first of all, you've got to, I always say it's really, I'm not a massive fan of mentorships, because I always find like mentors, what happens is you have a mentor and after a while it just becomes moaning. And so I talk in the book about career coaches, and so that's somebody who understands you and how you tick, but it's not a sibling, it's not somebody very close to you. And you talk through, you have to be very, very specific on what your fear is though, because I think when people say, oh, how do you help people? There's no use somebody coming to you going, I get stressed really easily, because it's too vague. I think if you're going to help someone, and in the book I talk about these career coaches, so find somebody who you really trust, who understands what your fears and anxieties are. But then I think the onus is on the individual to go, look, this is what I'm frightened of, and make it so specific that other person can work on it with you. And usually you only need like a 3-point plan of like, okay, this is what you're scared of, let's break it down into 3 things, because 3 is manageable. You do that with them, you work out a plan, and you work out a plan where you feel in control of that situation. You can do it by yourself. I mean, you know, diarising, keeping a diary is an incredible way. It's a very, very helpful way of doing that. But I tend to find it's better if you find someone who you trust. But it all goes back to specificity. It has to be.
Is that something you kind of brought into your workplace as well, around helping people, your staff?
Yeah, I try to. And I also, again, it goes back to what I was saying about exposure to the things that you're scared of. So, there's a lady in the office who doesn't, a lot of them don't like public speaking. And I was like, well, you know, there's this whole idea that it's better to do 20 different things in a year than do the same thing for 20 years. And I was like, well, what you should do if you don't like public speaking is you should start really, really small. So the next time we have a birthday drinks in the office, instead of me always doing it, why don't you do it? Or the next time you have, you know, Christmas dinner, why don't you raise the toast? And so what happens is, bit by bit, those start to become habits. And those habits, of course, and this happened to me in the book, I talk about, I turned up to an event I'd agreed to do, and I thought it was 200 people, and it was 20,000 people. But I was okay, because I had done lots of very small bits of public speaking. And because of that, my gut instinct, which of course gut instinct is pattern recognition, kicked in. So that's why I always say to people, particularly in my office, is just start really, really small. And you will, if you ever find yourself in a uncomfortable situation. By doing all those kind of little bits of practice, you will miraculously, and it feels like magic, but of course it isn't magic, you will be able to cope.
Build it up over time.
Yeah.
Being at Cosmopolitan, I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are on traditional media, but also social media's role in kind of our public image, and how that, you know, are there, you hear a lot that kind of Instagram and other platforms are portraying a false view of someone. Do you think that has any connection between that and our ability to embrace fear or to be able to fail well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a completely different subject, but of course I think, and I always say this, somebody asked me the other day, they said, well, with Instagram, it's really dangerous. And I was like, well, it depends how you use it, of course. And, you know, is the technology evil, or does the technology channel into our inner narcissist? But I always say to people, actually, if you are an older woman or man, but there are mainly women on the platform, you have a duty of care to not project this unreal life. So one of the things that I put on my Instagram is, this is not a true representation of my life. Does it increase fear? Well, it increases anxiety. Internal anxiety, because of course you have this image that you project to the world, and of course there's a massive step change between who the world thinks you are and who you think you are. But you know, there's a step change that happens before that, which is, you know, we know in the 80s and 90s the self-esteem movement took hold, and kids, in a well-meaning way by the way, were told, you can be anything you want to be, you're amazing. And that is also dangerous, because you have kids who have grown up thinking, oh my God, I can be anything, the world is open to me. And then they go out into the world and the world sends them a different message. So it's kind of the same as Instagram, but it's not. But do you see what I mean? So it's that big chasm between the two that is really dangerous. And I don't know if it's about fear that it's instilling, certainly anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting that you talk a bit about education, and you did just now as well in the book, around this sense that maybe we're kind of coddling children, or that impression of you can be anything, but actually, in reality, there are lots of barriers. Yeah. But we also hear a lot that students are really under pressure from exams and kind of pushed in a very particular way of success. Mm-hmm. What do you think education could be doing to help improve that, and to help kind of people take these steps throughout education?
That's a big question, because, you know, there's also the anxiety on teachers. You know, how much can teachers do?
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, we live in a highly individual time, don't we, where there's so much pressure put on the individual now. So, like, no such thing as a job for life, not really any chance of a pension, this is if you're a millennial. But I do actually think, you know, definitions of success has to come from the individual. And actually, I think there probably needs to be a new conversation around what success looks like, actually. You know, is success being a lawyer or a doctor, and is it getting top marks in your exam? Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I've always thought that success is, I kind of go by momentary success. So did I have a successful day? I think not a lot of people kind of sit back and look at the end of the day at what they've achieved. But I don't know about the teacher thing, because I think whilst there is a lot of pressure put on kids, I think there's also an enormous amount of pressure put on teachers. So you've got two lots of people who are put together in a very difficult situation. So that's a very ineloquent way of answering your question.
That kind of pressure that teachers are put under too is often sometimes forgotten about in that mix. And then you also talk in the book about this, you're not sort of talking about really deep traumas in this situation. And often we hear the kind of narrative that people who are disadvantaged maybe need to have better resilience in dealing with situations. But actually there are structural barriers that kind of are stopping people. Are there, I know this is quite a big question, but are there kind of things that you think should be happening in wider society that can help people to overcome these barriers? We do a lot of work here on kind of policy research. Are there things that the government should
you
be doing?
To help
people to have that kind of basis that they can then start from? Because it feels like to be able to do these kind of incremental changes, you also need to not be in a situation where you're really struggling with the kind of day-to-day practicalities.
Yeah, and you know, I think probably society probably needs to relook at the way it is. I think probably businesses need to do more. I think everybody goes, well, the change needs to happen in schools, and it does, of course, but it goes back to teachers having an enormous amount of pressure.
Yeah.
I think volunteering, I think all of us who are in most of us here who are older and wiser and in a fairly privileged position, I think volunteering has to become much bigger. You have to give back. I think that has to happen. I mean, you know, it really does. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, it's the age of volunteering, but sometimes I think about, well, is it conspicuous caring, you know? Until you actually are a volunteer, it's all very well and good to say, oh, volunteering. So I think people, you know, I would love to see it as part of someone's, you know, my job. I mean, actually, we do have that at Hearst, actually. You do have to do a couple of days volunteering. And Cosmo, actually, we do sex education in schools. We teach sex ed. So that's kind of our bit that we do. But yeah, I think it's kind of all coming together. And, you know, whilst government absolutely have a role and the education system has a role, I think as individuals here, we all have a massive role to play as well.
Yeah,
it's all about all the different groups coming together and all adding something rather than leaving it to one group to be working on stuff. Great, thank you. I'm going to open up to questions from the audience now. I'll take a couple at a time, so if you pop your hands up, there's a roving microphone coming around as well. Oh, actually, I'm going to take one from Twitter, first of all, and then the gentleman also behind you there, please.
I thought you were just on your phone the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's right in front of the lectern as well.
Yeah, no. We have a question from Twitter. What question are you most afraid of being asked today, and how would you answer it?
That's a good one. Okay, and the gentleman behind, please.
Well, probably the one you've just asked me.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a difficult one.
It's a difficult question because it's such a kind of macro question. And you know, you will know today I joined the Social Mobility Commission. So it's not something I'm equipped to give you an answer to because I have yet to pour through all of the research. And I'm going to have a really big job along with my other commissioners to do that. Yeah. So it's a brilliant question, but it's a really difficult one because I don't have the answer for you. And as a journalist, my desire is to give you an answer, but I can't. Yeah. So this one, from your own people.
Okay, let's bring the red
jumper. Hi there. I really loved your speech. Really accomplished, really comfortable on stage. Can you talk a little bit about language and how we're pathologizing language? So I've got a 13-year-old great-nephew who talks about his anxieties, and I just see him being nervous, which is normal for a 13-year-old, but it worries me. I'm not a doctor. I'm not sure if he has anxieties or not, but how we've amped up language, and if we're being specific about telling ourselves this isn't a fear, this is a challenge, how does language play a role in that?
Well, it plays a really strong role, doesn't it? Because as I said, you know, this incredibly compelling research is if you simply tell yourself, I'm scared, and then literally, and I remember before I had to, I did this very funny debate with Piers Morgan. It wasn't so funny, actually. it wasn't funny at all. But I was really scared. And you sit in the green room and he's flashing it up, going, the woman responsible for this cover's here. And simply just telling yourself through language, no, I feel challenged and I feel excited, flipped the way that I felt. And I completely agree with you. I mean, in Cosmo, we try and flip the language, actually, so we don't... whilst we deal with stress and anxiety, we kind of flip it. And rather than go, you're feeling stressed, you're this, we flip it and go, you're really tough. Let us tell you all the ways in which you are tough. So do we pathologize it? Sometimes. And, you know, that can be, if you tell yourself enough, we know this, that you feel anxious, well, then actually it starts to happen. So language is incredibly powerful. And I suppose my message to you would be, you tell him it's just nerves. Now, unless, of course, he has an anxiety disorder, which is a, you know, I'm not qualified to comment on that. But I think it's the same with stress, isn't it? It's like we package stress up and we go, you know, there are now stress holidays and everybody's going around going, I'm stressed. And it sometimes becomes a badge of honour, actually, to say that you're stressed. I think language has a massive role to play of turning that on its head.
Okay, a couple more questions, and definitely encourage people who wouldn't normally ask a question. This is the perfect time for you to do it.
It's not a hard one.
Yeah, yeah. The two people at the front here, please.
Thank you. Hi, Farah. You've spoken about not coddling the millennial generation, and you've addressed things like safe spaces. Were you worried about a backlash or pushback on Twitter? Because obviously, you know, if you use, they like to police language, I say they, but I was just wondering, you know, did you feel that you were willing to stick your head above the parapet and that's your role, or were you worried in...
It's a good question. Yes, I remember writing about the safe spaces in the book and thinking, definitely going to get pushback on this. The interesting thing is, though, I think as an editor, you cannot be afraid of that. And actually, I think... that is one of my roles. I mean, the truth is, I don't actually have a problem with trolls. I don't actually even like to call them trolls. They're just people who have a voice and they have a different opinion to you. And actually, so I don't have a problem with that. And I think a lot of Twitter, I find, is rather than... there's some insidious things on there. And it's not just Twitter, of course. But they just want to have their say, like most people. And actually, I think you have a duty to listen to most people's points of view. But, you know, when people say to me, oh, you offend me, that's all right. You can be offended. I don't have a problem with that. So, yeah, I think particularly if you're a journalist, you have a duty actually to sometimes raise the things that other people don't feel equipped to do. And it's just language, goes back to this gentleman, doesn't it? It's just language, it's just words, and actually you need to have divergent points of view. It's so important. So I was a little bit scared, but not so much. You couldn't edit a magazine if you were scared of Twitter reprisals.
Thank you. I've been browsing your book for the last half hour, and you have an anecdote about your teacher of running. You're exceptionally accepting feedback by the things that you put in your book. And we have a generation that is afraid of feedback because feedback appears to be failure. So what can we do to encourage the people like the lady that was mentioned to be embracing feedback and to be embracing incremental, you know, what do you call grinding? What can we do about that?
What can we do with it? Well, I think with the feedback, I mean, feedback is so important. Actually, I don't wait for kind of yearly career reviews of people. I give feedback constantly. And that way I always find it's like you can manage most things. It goes back to exposing yourself to the things that scare you, but you can do it in little incremental bits. So with feedback, I always think, I tend not to give more than 3 bits of feedback at any one time. But I also think feedback works in both directions, because whilst feedback is really scary to get, it's actually pretty scary to give feedback. Nobody likes to give it because you feel you're going to be excluded once you give it. So I suppose my advice would be, don't wait and don't make a big drama out of it. Do it in passing. Don't take someone into a room and go, going to give you feedback. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and it goes back to the language again. Once you start saying, here's some feedback, it becomes loaded. And actually, I have always found, my team may tell you differently, just getting out in the open and just making it a conversation. And I also say, when people give you feedback, guys, you've got to smile and say thank you, because it's really hard for that person to give as well. It works both ways.
Okay, a couple more, please. So the lady on the end of the row there, and then just in front.
Hi, I'm really excited to ask you a question, which is...
it makes me nervous.
Well, being excited to ask you a question is another way of saying that I've been sitting here scared to stand up and ask a question, but I'm stepping into the discomfort. I was really interested to hear you talk about reframing nerves or fear as excitement. I've definitely used that to overcome some of my fears about public speaking in particular. And I have encouraged my clients to do the same. I work as the leadership coach for introverts, and a lot of them worry about speaking and making presentations. My question, though, is about other ways to overcome fear, because some people are going to take a while to get to the point where they can just take that leap and reframe. So I wonder if you have any other tips for how to maybe take baby steps out of fear before you're ready to call it excitement.
Well, I think, I mean, look, there's nothing better than, sounds like what you're teaching them, which is little bit by bit. I mean, there's a lot to be said for visualisation. I mean, I think in the book I talk about a lot of athletes do it. So Wayne Rooney, before he had a match, and he would be scared, he would do everything from imagine what the socks were like when he was wearing, putting the socks on, the sensation of putting the socks on. Andy Murray goes and sits on centre court when he can before he does a match. I always say to people, you know, if you've got a job interview, think about, and of course now you can do so much research without looking like a stalker, of what the building looks like. You know, what is the carpet going to be like? What's the sound? So I think visualisation, imagining, and with the visualisation, of course, what we usually do when we visualise things is it ending really badly. So you think of it, when you imagine what the job interview is going to be like, you imagine, well, I'm going to fall over, I'm not going to answer the question. But I always say to people, imagine what an amazingly successful job interview would look like. And actually the way to kind of make that happen is to create a montage in a way of everything that will happen. And I've always found that it works for me, it works for other people that I've passed that on to. There is a chapter in the book all about it, because a lot of people rely on this. So I would say that's another way as well. Diarising as well really helps, you know, just letting it out there. Because of course when you put something in a diary, when it's not in your... sometimes your anxiety, when it's in your head and it's all jumbled, goes back to that sense of control. You're not quite sure what it is you're scared of, but it's like when you put something in a diary, it's a bit like editing, you can see quite clearly what it is that you're afraid of. So that would be the other thing I would suggest. You couldn't tell you were nervous.
Just in the middle row here.
Thank you very much for playing Jaws. It's actually my favourite movie, and I've seen it 100 times. I'm still scared every time. Nicholas Carr wrote an article, which he then turned into a book. It was a few years ago for The Atlantic, called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?"
Right.
And it reminds me of a quote by Henry Ford, which was, if I'd asked my customers what they wanted, they'd have asked for a faster horse and buggy.
That's right.
And Steve Jobs famously didn't take advice or invest in kind of focus groups. So the question I have for you is slightly tweaking Nicholas Carr. Do you think that Google is making us fearful in that we have too much advice, we have access to too much information, and that causes kind of paralysis by analysis and some of what you describe?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's a great question. I think one of the things is the burden of overchoice can make you, you know, fearful. But I actually think with Google, and I think with the digital age in general, actually what I think creates the fear is, of course, the thing is, and this is why I love magazines, I love digital, but I love magazines, is that it's discovery. So you turn a page and you don't know what you're going to be confronted with. And sometimes it's an opinion or a view that you don't agree with, but you are confronted with it. And actually being confronted with it and getting used to that is really good for you. I suppose my problem with not Google, but with digital is that it goes back to what I was saying in the talk, is that you're going in with a specific purpose. You know what you are looking for. And of course, when you go in knowing what you want, you're not going to confront yourself with views that you don't agree with. You're not going to confront yourself with scary things. So I think that is actually the problem. And that all goes back to human nature again, because our natural impulse is to shield ourselves away. It's to rest in comfort. And I think with the internet, you see that for sure. I mean, I do it myself sometimes. You know, that's why with Twitter now, I let the trolls be on there, because why would you block them? You know, it's not helpful to do that. Does that answer your question? Not really.
Okay, a couple more, please. Lady at the end with this row, and actually, let's take the gentleman on the same row as well.
I noted that you recently turned 40. I was actually wondering, was that something that you were at all concerned about, yes or no? And generally, how do you manage, again, from a female perspective, do you have a regime, and are you battling against the aging process?
No, I really love being 40. I feel like I've been 40 my whole life. Do you know why I really like it? Because actually, goes back to what I was saying to this gentleman, you're okay. I suppose you start to see that most of the truth lies somewhere in the middle, and you have enough life experience by about 40 to know that no side is actually right, and you're actually much stronger to deal and be faced with divergent viewpoints. And so I keep saying to my husband, and I don't know yet because I'm not well into my 40s, I'm only like, I don't know, 30 days into it. But I feel like it might be getting towards the age of expertise. You've just lived a little bit. And with aging, you know, I remember someone said to me really early on when I was in my 20s, they were like, never invest too much in the way you look, because it's the one thing that is going to leave you. It is certain, so don't. And so I never really thought about it. You know, that's why sometimes I always think, God, it must be, in some ways, it must be awful to be really beautiful, because you know it's going to leave you and you've got to find something to replace that. So, I actually really love being 40. Yeah, I really like it.
Do you have a beauty routine?
Do I have a beauty routine? Oh, I'm terrible. Like, I'm really bad. I mean, I don't have facials, really. I just, you know, I've got good skin. You know, I've got good heritage. My dad, you know, whilst in the 80s, I hated being half Pakistani because I had a really tough time. Actually, now, I feel really blessed, because it gives you, you know, genetically good skin. So no, I don't have a beauty regime. Moisturiser, wash my face and go.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's curious. You say that Cosmo, 80% of the staff quit, which must have been uncomfortable. Any interesting stories or lessons from that?
You know, what? People always go, did you fire them? I didn't fire anybody. And I wish they'd have stayed. But I do remember at the time. And it was hard for them because I came in. They had an editor who was really beloved. I mean, I loved her. She actually got promoted within the company. And so you have this new person that arrives and you have to change everything quite quickly. And I remember saying to everyone, guys, it's going to feel tough. I said, but when it feels tough, you have to trust me. That's a good thing because it means that things are changing. And I think, you know, there are lots of reasons why people leave when things change. You know, it's not always, might have been lack of faith in me. But there are lots of reasons. So, no, I just remember it got to a point where people would knock on my door and I'd go, you're leaving? They went, yeah. And then they'd just leave. So, yeah, it was very hard. Yeah, it was very difficult.
Okay, a couple more, please. Okay, Keely, just in the front, second front row here.
Hi. When at the beginning, when you said about closing your eyes and thinking of a scary thought that you could last think of, so mine was only when I was about 14, and I was thinking about...
You
went
very far back.
I went so far back to 14, and I was thinking about, I had to do a solo for Once in Royal David City at the local church. I was so excited, and I was like, yes, I'm ready for this, I'm scared, stiffless, but I'm going to do it. And I went, and I got out of my comfort zone, and I sang it, and I messed it up. It didn't go to plan. Every single year when it comes on, when I go to a carol service and someone else rocks it, I'm like, why didn't I do it? Why didn't it go to plan? And I always think, well, I have that day where I can just do it again and I'll ace it. So my question is, like, I guess, if you push yourself to go out of your comfort zone and it doesn't work and you go back into your shell and you're like, why did I even bother? Like, why did I do that? And then you wait so long maybe for that opportunity to happen again. I guess, did that ever happen to you? And if so, how do you pull yourself back up and get back into it?
Do you know what? I was given the solo of Once in Royal David City, and they chose two of us, and I went first. And you know you're rubbish. And then they took me off, and I never returned again. And I wish they'd have given me feedback and gone, just so you know, you were crap. But I wish they had, because I have the same thing whenever I hear that song. I'm like, but I think it goes back to, and I don't know if this gentleman touched upon it, it goes back to, you are going to get some things wrong. And that all goes back to reframing failure. You know, that's why Silicon Valley founders are obsessed with failure, because when you're trying something new where there's no information, you may well fail. So I think it's all about reframing failure. Failure because of carelessness is bad, right? But failure because you're trying something new is to be commended. So I think there's also there's a lot around, if you fail, it's okay. As long as you look back and go, really, I mean, I try to ask why 5 times. Why did I fail? What exactly was it? And again, that goes back to, okay, next time I do it, now I know. Because failure offers you an amazing piece of information you didn't have before. That's the way to do it, I think. You don't retreat. You use it as an investigative piece to go, okay, so this is why I failed. And next time you go in with the controlled kind of plan.
I was at carol service last year, and a boy did exactly the same thing. And I just wanted to go to him afterwards to say, you know, whatever you do, don't not do that again. Do it again, and you'll be fine. But yeah, it must be very stressful. A couple more then, please. Okay, at the back there, please.
Hi. Hello. I've just got a question about, I totally agree about being scared of kind of these digital bubbles and getting stuck on social media and stuff like that. What do you think the solutions are to that? And kind of related is, do you think there's a connection between the disconnection of like current modern society and our, you know, dislike of discomfort?
So the first bit of the question, you have to be pretty tough, and you actually have to expose yourself to different points of view. So actually, this is just a very practical example. If there is a columnist that you do not like, I would follow them. I think it's really important. I mean, that's why I like magazines. That's why I like conferences and events, because you're presented with something that you wouldn't ordinarily go looking for. So I think the onus is very much on you to go, okay, I live in this bubble, and you have to know that you live in the bubble. You then have to just expose yourself to, and that really takes an effort on your part. And I don't think everybody is prepared to do that, but I would say it's a really good thing to do. And then the second part of your question, I didn't understand it. So the disconnect of society?
Yeah, the disconnection I think that we face a lot in this society, in terms of people kind of stuck in their devices and stuck in a digital world, and how does, and it seems to be, you said that nowadays we're less, you know, open to discomfort, and I was wondering if you saw a connection between the two.
Well, probably, because it goes back to what we're saying. It's like, if you are over, depends how you use your phone, of course. If you're using it in the way that I just suggested, then perhaps not. But most people, you choose to surround yourself with people that you agree with. I mean, look at our social circles. It's very rare to say, I'm going out for drinks with my mate, there's one of them, we just don't agree on anything. It's very rare, we just don't do it. And so, yes, I mean, I wouldn't know the data on it, but I would suggest it has a massive impact, because what we're hunched over is probably that which we agree with, which goes back to the first part of your question, is which is why you have to follow and make sure that you are being exposed to people that you don't necessarily agree with.
Thank you. Take some from this side. Sorry, I realise I've not been looking in that direction. Yep, go ahead.
You've talked about analysing failures and kind of connecting to that. The two words I'm wondering about is survivor bias. You've undertaken difficult magazine launches in circumstances many in the industry wouldn't necessarily think of propitious, but you've survived it. And we can probably say thanks to that you're on stage here partly. So in your book, what tests do you have to kind of tell between a discomfort which is something you need to push yourself into and a discomfort which actually indicates your chances of survival are actually going to go down quite a lot? So, yeah.
I think when I'm talking about exposing yourself to discomfort, I think most people are pretty much aware of where they're, of what they find uncomfortable. I'm definitely not saying put yourself into completely uncharted territory, because I think that would be wrong, and I think actually you would probably come away with further trauma. So I don't think so. And I think it goes back to, you don't throw yourself into something you've never done before. It's the little bit, it's incremental. I mean, you know, even though I was thrown into launching Women's Health, remember, I had years and years of experience of taking on difficult projects. So it wasn't, I think if I'd just been thrown into it and I'd been a junior writer and it was like, now go and edit this magazine, it would have been traumatic for sure. So I think you have to be, in that sense, very self-aware of, and I think most people, if they ask themselves, they know what they find uncomfortable, and then it's bit by bit approaching it with a plan. Yeah, I definitely don't think throwing yourself into something which you are completely unsuited for and which is sheer discomfort and you're ill-equipped to handle, I agree. I'm not advocating that.
Okay. And a couple more from this side, because I've been a bit unfair on the balance.
I was just raising my hand for him.
Okay. In that case, here and then at the back, please.
So I work with teams building sporting challenges. And in every team I work with, there is one person, maybe two, who just, it's not for them. They've tried something like this before, that team bonding, maybe it's the word sport, maybe it's physical activity, they do it on their own. Do you have any tips as to how I can bring those people in an inclusive way that makes them feel comfortable? Because it's a playtime thing that brings levelling back into work, but it's something that I'm struggling to grasp a bit.
So you have, is it children?
No, it's fully grown adults.
Okay, and for some of them it's just not for them.
Yeah, it's not for them, but then there is an element of, there's some success stories where there is a Terry and a Brenda who did that little bit of cycling on the cross trainer and it's changed their life and they've now built these amazing habits that make them a better person to be around and they feel better amongst themselves. So it's kind of coaxing someone on that journey just to take that step into whatever might be their Everest kind of thing.
I mean, that it depends how far down the line they are, because I sometimes do think with some things, if people have really tried and they just can't make it work, I kind of don't believe in forcing people. I think if the effort has been there and the will has been there, it's like the reason I asked whether it was kids, it's, you know how there are some kids and they're just not sporty and they really try and there's a well-meaning teacher who goes, come on, it's about team building. I think at some point you do have to give up, because I think if somebody has tried and failed repeatedly, I think that can be damaging. So I don't know with Terry and Brenda is the answer. I mean, you know, what sort of sport is it?
It's whatever they want to do. So each person picks their own challenge. There is no, you have to do this. So there's an element of flexibility.
But then that goes to choice, doesn't it? So there must be some sort of offering that, because sometimes sport looks different. Sport can be walking, sport can be being on a cross trainer. So perhaps you just need to do the work with them. You know, maybe it could be, goes back to language again, you know, the idea of sport. Well, sport is very different for lots of, you know, I ramble with my dogs at the weekend. It's not sport, but it kind of is. So maybe it's the language around sport. I often find that with sport, even when I'm writing about sport, you say the word sport. Some people have a real, you know, they have a real aversion to it. So you probably just have to need to do a bit of exploring with them and maybe change the way that you sell it to them. Give them the control to go, look, this is what I'm into, rather than going, look, you need to do sport. I think it needs to come from them.
Okay, and then the final question.
This is a similar question about survivor bias. You mentioned a couple of times in your talk when something completely out of your control helps your career a lot. The former editor of Women's Health resigning. If she hadn't resigned, the post wouldn't have been available at the right time for you. That the editor of Cosmo being promoted up. Whatever events in your life were completely out of your control, but where luck or chance was in your favour, helping you get where you are today?
Well, it's whether it's luck or chance, really, because I think with Women's Health, I heard that there was a position going, and I could have gone no, but I put myself forward for it. So I tend not to chalk up anything to luck or chance. I tend to chalk up to, I listen to the grapevine and then kind of, because it goes back to control. This is just a personal belief, but I'm not good when I think things are left to chance or luck. It feels out of my control. And so I like to always think, even though it's not always the case, that I have kind of autonomy over where I'm going. So, yeah, I don't really have any examples of luck. I mean, you know, I'm very lucky. I was best friends with my husband for years and years. He didn't have a girlfriend for years. He met somebody when he was at Glastonbury. I wasn't with him. And it was like a sliding door. It was like, do I tell him how I feel about him or do I not? Now, I was lucky in that he phoned me that night and said, oh, I'm here, I miss you. It's not the same without you, but I've met someone. Now, is it luck or actually, I engineered it and said, actually, I need you to come back to London and there's something I need to tell you. So I'm not answering your question very well, but I don't ever look at things, I don't ever see my life as being lucky, actually. I feel it's that old cliche, and they're clichés for a reason, aren't they, is, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. I've always subscribed to that a bit more. Because if I thought that a lot of my life was due to luck, then I wouldn't know where I was heading, because I would think, well, it's all in kind of, it's all, you know, the stars aligning, and that would find, I would find that very difficult to know where I was going. I like to know where I'm heading for.
Yeah, it's interesting getting that balance between knowing what you've kind of achieved yourself and worked for, and also what things have kind of aligned with that, you realising that you've been able to listen out for and take advantage of in that moment.
That all goes down to, that's still about your autonomy. Yeah. It's about you listening in and you kind of leaning in and going, okay, I hear it, you know, there is an opportunity
that I can take advantage of.
Yeah, I think so, for me anyway.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to wrap up there. I'm sorry if we've not been able to take your question, but Farah is signing books outside, so please do go along and say hello and pick up a coffee. So please join me in thanking Farah Storr.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.